The way I was going to start was to tell you that recently I had lunch with my friend and colleague and teacher, Rabbi Harold Schulweis, from Valley Beth Shalom. And like two old rabbis, we were comparing operations as we shifted the mahjong tiles back and forth. And Rabbi Schulweis told me a remarkable story. He said, when he had a heart operation and was in the hospital, the rabbi, Rabbi Levi Meir, came in on a Friday night before Shabbat and lit candles for him because he couldn't get up, and stayed and talked for a little while and then left. And it just so happened, since people of all religions make the rounds in hospitals in L.A., that a Buddhist monk came by and saw that a rabbi was in there. So he went in and they talked for a while and spoke about different things. And then as he was leaving, the monk said to Rabbi Schulweis, "Well, I suppose it's time for you to go to sleep. Shall I blow the candles out?" And he said, "No, actually, according to our tradition, you're not allowed to blow the candles out, the Shabbat candles. They have to stay lit as long as they can until they burn themselves out, but we're not allowed to burn them out." To which the monk replied, "That's the difference between Buddhism and Judaism. Because in Buddhism, nirvana means to blow out. But we don't believe in blowing out. We don't believe in extinguishing. We don't believe in giving up on wanting. It's true, the Buddhist insight. Our yearning makes us unhappy. If we didn't want, we wouldn't be frustrated, we wouldn't be angry, we wouldn't be unfulfilled. But it is also true, the Jewish insight. Our yearning makes us human. We understand in our tradition the wisdom of letting things be, but much more often we preach the wisdom of tikkun olam, of fixing things, of making them better, of beautifying it, of never, ever, ever giving up. Does it lead to frustration? Absolutely. The rabbinic midrash on Kohelet says quite explicitly, no one leaves this world with half of his wishes fulfilled. And that's tragic. But how much more tragic would it be to look around this rich, marvelous, and beleaguered world and find nothing else to wish for? The Zohar, the central book of Jewish mysticism, says we are children from the chamber of yearnings. We want, we seek, we yearn. Have you ever wondered, and I'm sure you have at one point or another, why did the Western world create technology and modern science? Why was it not born in the East? According to Daniel Boorstin, the late Librarian of Congress, the reason that the Western world created technology is that we took our model from the Hebrew Bible, and the Hebrew Bible has a God who creates. And so we believe in creation. We're always fixing things, changing things. I'm sure that in part that's why we have Kol Nidre. Because you have to be careful. Kol Nidre is all about promising to do stuff that we end up not doing. Because we always want it. We're going to do it. I promise I'm going to do it. I want to do it. It should be done. I know I'll do it. And in fact, at the very beginning of Kol Nidre, and some of you weren't here yet, but at the very beginning, I know you're going to tell me it was our fault, but whosever fault it was, I just want to let you know, We say you can pray together. In English, it's with the transgressors. In Hebrew, it's avaryanim, which does literally mean those who transgress. To transgress is to cross a boundary. And you know what word comes from the same root as avaryanim? We read it tomorrow in Jonah. When they say to him, "What are you?" he says, "Ivri anochi." I'm a Hebrew. I'm a Jew. To be a Jew is to learn how to cross boundaries. It is to be me'aver, on the other side, always pushing, always moving beyond. And while we recognize that that is sometimes a bad thing, it's also a good thing. The author of The Little Prince, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, said, if you want to teach someone how to build a ship, don't give them measurements and wood and instructions. Teach them how to yearn for the sea. That's what we believe. And that's why we have been so prevalent since we exploded out of our villages and our ghettos in all the creative arts, in music, in literature, in art, and also in science, in teaching. We believe in building, in creating, in beautifying. We have a concept in our tradition called Hidur Mitzvah, which means beautifying the mitzvah. You don't just do it, you serve it up with relish. To quote Cagney, an old rabbi. So this is preamble to something that I realized and something that I yearn for. A few months ago, I was in New York speaking to an educators conference, and I had a night off. So I went to the theater. It's in New York. Now, many of you know, maybe most of you know, that the number one show on Broadway right now is a show called Wicked. It's the story of the Wizard of Oz told from the point of view of the Wicked Witch. It is produced by a member of our congregation, Mark Platt, and he and his wife Julie, and for that matter their children, have been dear and cherished friends of Ellie's and mine for many years. So I went to see it. And right before the show was ready to start, Mark came over to where I was sitting and he said, "Don't talk during the show." No, he said, he said, "I want you to know what you're about to see is a very Jewish story." So I imagine myself something of a pro at Jewish stories. And I was ready. And I paid attention. And it was, in fact, a Jewish story. Because it is all about this. First of all, remember, the witch comes out in a long black coat. I'm just saying. Okay? Just saying. And it's all about her inability to fit in. And why can't she fit in? It's not really because she's evil, but because she's different. And she tries to fit in, but it never works, because she really is different. She really can't slide smoothly into the society around her because she's not comfortable with it. She thinks it's somewhat dishonest. It's a Jewish story. It was made more interesting, it was compounded, and I'll get to the original movie in a minute, by the fact that he got a letter shortly afterwards from a high school girl who was a Palestinian. And she said, I sat in the theater and I cried. Because when I wear a head covering, people hate me. They don't know me, but they hate me. They automatically cast me out and make me different. And I thought, by the way, that there's something to the original story, too, that makes it a Jewish story. Forget not only the black coat, but think of the Wicked Witch with the long hook nose and the cackle. Who, by the way, and she's green. I won't talk about economic stereotypes because that may be pushing it, but she's green. By the way, you know, Dorothy kills her sister. And all she wants in return is her sister's shoes. There is a way of looking, even at the original movie, that the witch is badly treated. And certainly that's true in the show. And when I saw that letter from that Palestinian girl, an idea grew inside of me that I had been thinking about for a long time. Because I thought, what if that character had really been a Jew? Not someone that you had to sit in the audience and decide was a Jew, but really was an identified Jew in the show. After all, this is, by many measures, the most powerful city in the world. This is the city that creates the images that everyone else in the world watches. I mean, you can write a book, and you might reach thousands of people, maybe if you're lucky, 1 million, 2 million people, but you make a movie, and it goes all over the world. Millions and millions of people will see it. So where are the Jews? Where are they? I mean, I watch movies, I watch television, where are they? It's better than it once was. When Harry Cohn was the CEO of Columbia and he said, there are no Jews in my pictures, they're all dead or Indians. It's not that way anymore. But we speak all the time about the way Israel presents itself to the world. But what do you think people in this country think about Jews? About Judaism? What do you think they learn in their churches and in their scriptures? Part of the debate about Mel Gibson's Passion was because Jews have no idea the extent to which their views, their religious views, are completely unknown. I've had this experience again and again. When I have spoken at Christian colleges, this is what happens, quite literally. I'm not making this up. I'll give you a this exactly happened when I spoke once at Oral Roberts University. It's a fascinating experience, but that's for another time. I spoke in front of the student body, which is 5,000 people. And afterwards, I met with a small group of students in chapel, and they got to ask questions. Now, these were bright students. I spoke to them for a while. But this is exactly how the exchange went. The first one raises his hand and says, well, tell me, in what way do you think Jesus is God? So I explained that, in fact, we don't believe that. That that's not part of our tradition. Next question. Well, in what way do you see him as the Messiah? And this question, in one form or another, recurred 5 or 6 times. Because they have no idea. Now, the reason I bring this up is because 3 days ago, I had a child of a Holocaust survivor sitting in my office who had no religious upbringing, but has been caught up by a group which preaches Christianity, although they call it Messianic Judaism, but that's another name for Christianity. And he asked me the same thing. And when I told him the same answer, which is, there is no place in my faith system for that which you believe, he asked it again and again. Because he's never heard what Jews believe anywhere. If you don't get it in day school and you don't go to synagogue, where do you find it? We are allowed to make films about the Holocaust. That we know. You can make films about how Jews died, just not about how they live. I spoke on Rosh Hashanah about our obligation to the world, but what about our obligation to tell our story? I can't turn on the TV without seeing a minister. Why, in an industry full of Jews, do I never see a rabbi? Billy Graham, to take a good, respectable, thoughtful example. The man, through television and other things, made hundreds of thousands of people devout Christians and made thousands of people into ministers. Are there no Jewish voices that could do the same? But we don't hear them. We don't see them. You know, if there is a popular Jewish singer, sooner or later they will release an album that has on it Amazing Grace and Ave Maria. Where's Avinu Malkeinu? Can you imagine what that would do for a young Jew who listens to music all the time? To hear a rock star whom they admire sing Avinu Malkeinu? To see a television show that doesn't make Judaism into a caricature? Fiddler on the Roof is about a world lost. It fits perfectly the Christian stereotype about Judaism being something that was, not something that is. But is there nothing about to celebrate about the world we have found? About the world we have created together? Is there nothing to celebrate in you? In what you are and what you've done and in what you believe? We all know that in show business, Jewishness is a shtick. For the Larry Davids and the Woody Allens and the Adam Sandlers in the world, it's a comic hook. For writers, too often, it's an object of satire or nostalgia, and there is nothing wrong. With finding humor in our tradition. But Judaism is not, it is not about making jokes and getting killed. That's not Judaism. Mordechai Kaplan said almost a century ago, if your Judaism is about anti-Semitism, then your Judaism is a complex, not a civilization. And I don't know about you, but I'm not willing to give my life to a complex. I'm not willing to teach my daughter that she is one in the millennial tradition of Jewish jokes. We are the people who keep the candle burning, and that candle is not a joke. It's about Torah and community and prayer and faith. I'm tired of righteousness always being portrayed as self-righteousness and faith always being portrayed as fundamentalism. Where is our eloquent, searching, probing, ancient faith? Where do we find it? We are a gifted and passionate people. We gave the idea of one God to the world, that all human beings spring from one source, Surely we should be talking about what we believe and why. It's not easy. It takes an enormous amount of effort. You know the English proverb that the smooth sea never made a skilled sailor. That's how you get good at something, by working at it. It's not easy. To make a beautiful, compelling, coherent image of what Jews believe. And all Jews won't sign on to it. And there will always be competing visions. But here in this city, in this synagogue, are people who make these movies and television shows, who decide, or at least who have a hand in deciding, what it is that we see. Why don't we see us? I know that it's hard. I really do. I know that I write a sermon and then I come down here and I give it. And I don't have to go through 1,000 committees and corporations and all these things. I realize that. But come on, we're really good. We are really good. You know the story about Matisse and Renoir? At the end of Renoir's life, he had arthritis. And for him to create was enormously painful. And one day Matisse was in his studio and he said to him, "Why do you keep doing it? I can see how you wince with each stroke." And Renoir said, "The pain passes, but the beauty lasts forever." It would be hard, but the effect would be enormous. Somewhere out there, there is a Jewish child who doesn't have any role model, not in his city, where he's the only Jewish family, not in his music, not in his movies, not in his television, nowhere. And nobody in that small city can give it to him, only we can. He's not going to go to a Jewish site on the internet. He's just not. You want to see SinaiTemple.org? It was just redesigned. It's beautiful. He's never going to see it. But he'll see it on TV. He'll hear the other kids in school saying to him, "Did you know there was this Jewish show or Jewish guy?" He'll hear that. He'll start to learn what he's supposed to believe, or at least what his people believes. And wouldn't that be something? There is, and some of you may have read it in high school, this story by Jack London called To Build a Fire. It's about a guy who's stuck in a snowstorm and he has one match. And the entire story hinges on, will he get this match lit and save himself or not? And the one way that you know that he will be saved is if he lights the match and someone else sees it. We have in this city and in this congregation the means to show that light to others. To save what we cherish by that candle that we don't blow out. But we have to believe in the tradition, in its power, in its permanence. Judaism isn't perfect. It's not perfect. We have an awful lot to learn from the world. We have learned an awful lot from the world. But I will tell you the day on which Judaism will die. It will die on the day we no longer believe that we have something important and vital and lasting to teach the world. If we don't, we may as well fold up our tent and go home. But we do. And so we're here. You may remember the tale. It's a beautiful and often told one, but it really fits. It's a tale told of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, that when he needed a miracle, he would go to a special place in the forest and light a special candle and say a special prayer, and God would grant him the miracle. A generation passed, and his student, the Magid of Mezrich, no longer had the candle because it had burned down, and he would go to the place in the forest and recite the prayer and say to God, I no longer have the candle, but I know the place in this forest, and I know the prayer, and that has to be enough, and it was enough. When Rabbi Israel of Rizin succeeded him, the Jews had been wandering, and they had lost their place in the forest. And so he would sit in the Beit Midrash in the house of study and look up at God and say, I don't have the candle and I don't know the place in the forest, but I remember the prayer. And that has to be enough, and it was enough. But the generations passed and persecutions touched our people. And in the last generations, when Rabbi Shlomo needed a miracle, he would sit in his study and look up at the sky and say, Ribono Shel Olam, dear God, the candle is gone. We've lost the place in the forest, and I no longer remember the prayer, but I know the story, and that has to be enough. And it was enough. The world awaits our story. We are the only ones who can tell that story. And in 20 years, if we learn to tell it, then Judaism will be known as it is not known now. I pray that God grants us that those who are the storytellers of our people will tell the stories of our people, so that our light, ablaze for 3,000 years, will never go out.